Hey, and welcome to Stopping By. I'm Doug Pierce, Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor with Pinnacle Wealth Partners at UBS Financial.
And I'm Jess DeBeer, Associate Director and Senior Wealth Strategy Associate, also with Pinnacle Wealth Partners. We are located in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, and can be reached at pwp@ubs.com.
Our team's mission, our just cause, is to bring financial literacy and competency to the masses. We've been fortunate to meet interesting people along the way. They have compelling life stories about overcoming adversity and seeking their passions. Hopefully, you'll see that our guests are just like you. So Jess, who's stopping by today?
Doug, we're changing things up today. Okay, we're switching gears, testing new waters, because today we're going to talk about grief. Joining us is the incredibly delightful Stephanie Greenleaf. She is a licensed associate counselor and therapist. She is not affiliated with UBS Financial Services Incorporated, and her views are her own.
Awfully bubbly talk about grief today, Jess.
Let's
I'm excited for some free therapy. Let's see who's stopping by. I'll tell you what.
Tell me.
Sitting here, and I feel like we're both having a really good hair day. It's a shame this is a podcast. I really like your setup here. I like the candle in the background. It's a very
zen, right?
Environment. Yeah, man.
I know. When the people stop by, I want them to feel relaxed.
They feel like, yeah, she's kicked back. We need to have our guests lying on a couch. We'll get more from them.
Well, today's guest is going to have us lying on a couch, right?
Hey-o! Hey-o! Is that a tease? They call that a tease in the biz.
Have you ever experienced grief?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I had my grandparents that lived with us when they got older. They died like in succession. That was high school. That was the first time it was like, wow, this sucks. And then, You know, I've been through some breakups. I've been in and out of stuff. Grief.
There's a difference, though, don't you think, between breakup grief and death grief?
Yeah, maybe the death so being so final versus a breakup, but I don't know. I feel like I didn't distinguish.
Well, it's the death of the relationship, right? But like, I mean, I've broken
you get some better hard. With it over time. I think you get better with it over time, which is where death is a little bit more you can still harbor.
Death grief is. It stops you in your tracks, man.
Hello.
Hi. Hey. Gorgeous.
So fun.
Is she so fabulous, Doug?
I'm loving this. I was just telling Jess, I said, you know, the vibe that she's got going on with the candles in the background, you have a fire going on in the background. This is
right.
I can get comfy there. I feel I'm comfy already. This is good.
All right. Shall we kick it off, kids?
Sounds good.
All right, Doug. As I mentioned in our very important and necessary disclaimer introduction today, we have to do this disclaimer intro before every podcast. Okay. Mm-hmm. Today, we are talking about grief. My dad, the fabulous Richard M. Corbin, was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in early of 2016, and he passed away just 8 months after that. And this year, when his diagnosis date rolled around, I was, of course, thinking of dad, and I'm feeling all the feels, and I want to talk about grief, because nobody can escape grief, right? So today, I am thrilled to bring Stephanie Greenleaf to our Stopping By listeners. Steph is a licensed associate counselor, dance movement therapist, and national certified counselor at the Chrysalis Counseling Center located in Morristown, New Jersey. She received her master's in clinical mental health from Rider University and also holds a master's in communications from LaSalle University. She helps clients who have experienced trauma, anxiety, depression, grief, addiction, and challenging life transitions, just to name a few. She also teaches an absolutely fabulous butt-killing Tabata Bar class most Fridays at 9 a.m. Morristown Rec Center.
That's the next podcast where we take that class.
Yeah, we're gonna bring our weights. Ladies and gentlemen, you're in for a treat, as Steph is an absolute doll. I love, love, love her. So without further delay, Steph Greenleaf, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you for having me. And that was quite the intro. Yeah, it's always interesting to hear your life reflected back like that.
I have a quick question before we dive in here. I'm getting some conflicting information, because is it Stephanie with an I or an IE?
So that's kind of part of my past life. So in my undergraduate degree, I went to Penn State and I was a musical theater major and had been a ballerina my whole life. So when I was in that world, So when I was in that world, we kind of took the E off of my name to just kind of make it stand out more.
Oh, like a stage name-y?
And quirky. Yeah. But I never legally changed it because it was only one letter and didn't seem that deep.
It's that whole persona. It's like Beyonce has Sasha. I think that's her stage presence. You're the same way. It's just like when you drop that E, look out.
Look out.
That's right. So I can use it to kind of manage different personalities, but that's not what this podcast is.
Oh, boy. So that's really interesting. So you were a ballerina for how long?
So, I mean, that's kind of all part of how I ended up in this field, believe it or not. So I was a ballerina my whole childhood, adolescent life, ended up with a hip injury that was career ending when I was around 18 years old. And that's kind of when I pivoted to making musical theater the kind of dream. Realized I didn't really have the kind of drive it takes to live in the cardboard box and go to the auditions and kind of like work the system. Mm-hmm. So I went back and got a master's degree in communication from LaSalle, like you said, and I spent a lot of time working in nonprofit arts organizations at that time. Mm-hmm. Met my husband. We had children. I stayed at home while he went through his residency program. And then I kind of ended up in this like spot in my life where I have three kids. What's my identity? Like, I used to be a dancer my whole life. What am I now if I'm not Sadie, Jake, and Bo's mom? And that's when I started teaching the bar classes. So I was into exercise, and it was this way of kind of getting back that dancer, arty personality part and kind of incorporating it into my current life. And then I just needed some more. So as the kids got older, I went back and got another master's degree in clinical mental health to be a therapist. And I did do a dance movement therapy certification in addition to that, so that I am still kind of marrying all these areas of my life, all of my different journeys into kind of one pitch.
Well, so tell us more about dance movement therapy. What is this? Can anybody do it? Like, talk to us.
So dance movement therapy is one of the creative arts therapy. So I think most people have heard of art therapy by this point, if you're familiar with just therapeutic practice in general, where you use art and different mediums to kind of work through feelings and identify different repressed emotions that you might be feeling. And then there's also music therapy. So using instruments and lyrics to kind of help promote psychological wellness. And then dance movement therapy is using movement, breath, expansion, those kind of things to kind of process trauma, to make someone feel safer in their bodies. So a lot of times if we are working with a client experiencing trauma, they might be closed in on themselves, you know, looking down, they're depressed, there's a tightness to their body. So it would be just like, what emotion comes up when you are vulnerable, when your arms are open, and kind of exploring that.
Okay, so I'll be the skeptic. I was the skeptic. I'm not a skeptic, I'm a believer, because I read a book a long time ago called The Body Keeps the Score. And there is science to this, right? Where like when you're performing in these things, I hear that and like a dance, like, hey, if you tell me to dance it out, it's not something I fully embrace. No. But talk to us a little bit about the science of it. Cause there is, right? They've done studies and where people are in groups and how this all happens. And what is it, a left brain, right brain?
Yeah. And if you think about it, we have taught specifically our culture, this isn't necessarily true in other cultures, but we are a very intellectualized society. So we are taught to think through problems, come up with the decision. What is the solution? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times we don't address the body, and the body knows first. So if you think kind of back to, you know, primal instincts, that fight or flight that we talk about all the time, when something is happening to you, if someone is a lion is coming at you, or you hear a noise that makes you feel frightened, your body goes first. Your body signals to your brain, like, we should be scared. You're feeling anxious. You start to hold your breath, right? Mm-hmm. You don't realize that you do it, but you're breathing a little more shallow. You're holding your breath a little closer. Your brain is going to be signaled, we're not getting enough oxygen. Why are we breathing slower? Something is happening. Tip into a panic attack, right? So it's always starting in the body, but we just haven't created an awareness around those initial sensations, those initial triggers. So it's kind of slowing down and saying, okay, I don't need to be in panic mode right now. I don't need to listen to the primal instinct. I am safe. How can I feel safe in my body? I'm having heart palpitations. And what can I slow those down? So it's called biofeedback, I think, is a lot of the science that you're talking about, where you really do work on the reactions within your body to then be able to control and emotionally regulate before it's signaled to the brain.
Is that dialectical behavioral therapy? Is that the same thing?
You want to try to say it seven times?
No. No, I don't want to do that at all. I don't even want to say crystal counseling.
I want to hear you say it seven times fast. Go.
No, dialectical behavioral therapy is actually very different. So dialectical behavioral therapy, which is called DBT, is it kind of works with the idea of there's two sides, right? Like there's a gray area. And dialectical behavioral therapy was created to deal more with personality disorders. So that's for borderline personality disorder, narcissistic personality disorder, people that find it challenging interacting with people, that the emotions feel very big and a lot of impulsivity. So DBT is kind of a skills-based therapeutic approach that involves like handouts and skill building. So we do emotional regulation is a cornerstone of DBT.
Okay.
Learning how to kind of, maybe if the stimulus is tiny and you tend to react really big, like how can we get those on the same field?
Okay.
And also dealing with interpersonal effectiveness is another cornerstone of DBT, teaching people how to assert themselves and advocate for themselves while maintaining respect and active listening. And then the biggest one that kind of tips into grief a little bit, probably the most, is distress tolerance as a principle. That same kind of thing of the idea of the stimulus, right? Like, what is your window of tolerance? How much can you handle before your emotional reaction, your impulsive behavior? How much can you tolerate? So it's kind of about expanding that window of tolerance so that you're not scratched by a minor thing and create a big reaction.
Huh.
Right? So how much you can handle.
So this is fascinating to me.
Doug. Yeah. Well, right? So I'm thinking about this. So somebody that it's like a fish doesn't know it's wet, right? So somebody that needs therapy and they're seeking this out, how do they know to seek these types of things out? Are there like referrals made within the therapy community, or is there a good way to self-identify that I maybe should try this kind of stuff? How does it typically happen?
It's kind of tough for the client to kind of know what they don't know, right?
Right.
So I think you seek out a therapist and you know, you can read on their profile what they specialize in. I use a little bit of DBT in my practice, but I'm not a huge handout skills building person. I kind of practice more of what we call a humanistic or person-centered approach.
Mm-hmm.
But when I did work at Penn Medicine, we do a very strong DBT program there. So that's a lot of acuity. You know, you're coming out of a very depressive episode or an inpatient stay, and you need the skills to be able to stay safe. So you can read what therapeutic practices certain therapists use typically, like we can identify that. But as a consumer, it's not necessarily like you would know what we're even talking about if you read it.
Okay.
So I think we have learned, and you know, it is fact at this point, and a lot of research has been done, that the number one factor in successful therapy or seeing progress in therapy is the therapeutic relationship. So it's the rapport between you and your therapist. So the most important thing is finding someone that you connect with and that you feel safe with. And then the approach will, you know, they will be able to identify different approaches that might work better for you, whether it be cognitive behavioral therapy or narrative therapy, as you go down that road with them. Mm-hmm. But the most important thing really is the rapport.
Yeah.
And I think that we act like that's something that should just be, you go to the doctor, you see him for 20 minutes, they tell you what's wrong with your back and you leave. But here you're supposed to be talking about your darkest days and your biggest fears, and you need someone you connect with. So I kind of say you might go through a dating process where you meet with someone and you're like,
I don't like this person.
We were literally just talking about this before you popped on, because Doug and I have both had our are little skips of therapy for totally different reasons. So we were talking about this very thing. Like, you know, you meet someone and you're like, I don't want to talk to this person. Or, or you feel like, I don't want to bother this person. I don't want this person to be bored by all of my stuff. So what advice can you give people for that? Like taking the reins and not feeling bad about burdening somebody. I mean, you're paid to do this, right? But it was personally hard for me to go there because I felt guilty for unloading my stuff on them.
By the way,
100%.
I just wanted to say I had no problem with that. I was paying, so I had no problem with burdening anyone with anything.
Like, I wonder if that's a male-female thing. Like, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. We don't want to be too much, right? Like,
right.
We don't want to be too much. I think the biggest thing with that is being honest about that feeling. Mm. Right. So as therapists, I love it when a client says that to me. When they say, sometimes I feel like I'm just sitting here whining to you and I don't want you to feel annoyed or I don't want you to feel burdened.
Yeah.
And I get to respond with what we call unconditional positive regard. Like, I don't get to see you as a friend of mine.
Right.
I get to see you as a therapist and client, and I can love you and adore you and help you through this, but it is my job. So lay it on me. Mm-hmm. You do not have to protect my feelings in any way. You
know? Is that ever, I know I'm going off script here, but I have a thousand questions. So is it difficult at the end of the day, if you are counseling somebody, to leave it at the office? Because I'm sure things bubble up that are hard to hear.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll add a little more.
Next question.
It is very hard. And I actually was thinking about this the other day. I said, I'm glad my career path went the way that it did, because I don't know if I would have been successful being able to separate work in my 20s. You know, think that now I do have a life perspective.
Right.
And you do feel it. I think I have become a little more introverted since I started this field. I kind of like my blanket and my tea and a cocoon at the end of the night. Mm-hmm. But I think there's beauty in that. You know, I feel very honored to be able to hold that space for people and to be trusted with the thoughts that they don't want to say out loud. And it really is a very, you know, humbling and honoring experience. So
yeah,
I'm willing to kind of take the weight that comes with that.
The personal connection is important. And we said in our business, like, the reality is you can buy Apple anywhere, right? And so in order for you to help somebody from an investment perspective, or they're talking about their financial thing, they have to be able to willing to, here's what I'm trying to accomplish. This is what I'd like to do. If they don't have that relationship, you don't get anywhere with people.
Let's get to the meat and potatoes here. So let's talk about grief. So as I understand it, there are 5 stages of grief, right? I'm like going back to my psychology class: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. So first of all, do these stages happen typically in this specific order? And can you kind of elaborate on the stages and tell us how they are helpful in the healing process when we grieve?
Well, I'm about to like blow the lid off of this.
All right. Okay? Turn up your dials.
Buckle up.
It's a scam. What you're referring to is The Stages of Grief by Kubler-Ross. She was a psychiatrist, and she developed these stages of grief as a way of making sense of the process that people are going through when given a terminal diagnosis. So these stages of grief that you're referring to were specifically developed for someone that was receiving a terminal diagnosis and was coming to terms with their own diagnosis.
Wow.
Now, we as a culture really love a task list, right? We're like, how can we take this complex problem, make it simple, and give me a checklist? Oh, here I am in denial now. Oh, look, I'm moving into anger, right? So
I love that idea.
Thank you. But thank you for taking grief and making it this digestible thing that tells me how to do it right.
Yeah.
But that is
a scavenger hunt.
Yeah. And that is not how it works. I mean, wouldn't it be nice? But it is not how it works. There are no stages. It is not a linear process. Mm. It is something that will knock you down. It is something that you will ride a wave. It is something that will show up when you think, oh, I thought I was doing better. I thought I was over it.
Yeah.
And then the next day, there it is again.
Yeah.
So I think this pressure of following these stages and there being a goal is not
realistic.
There's something that's come out since then called conscious grieving that I resonate a little bit more with. That's Claire Bidwell Smith. And it's less of the stages, you know, of the denial, anger, bargaining, and more of just phases that there's a universality to, right? Mm-hmm. So she talks about entering into grief. So that's the thing happens. I am now greeting it. I have to enter into this space because it is my reality. Mm-hmm. And there's engaging with grief. Grief is a universal thing. So if you've happened to experience something where all of a sudden you're going, I need to read every book. I need to listen to every podcast. Like, tell me how to do it. Tell me how.
How to get through it, how to fix it.
Mm-hmm. Right. You're trying to make sense of the thing that happened. Mm-hmm. And then you eventually lead into a surrender or just this acceptance of, and they do, DBT calls it radical acceptance. This idea that not it is what it is. No. Not that I'm glad this happened. Not that there's a silver lining, but just truly this happened and I am accepting that it did. That's it. Not attaching too much emotion to it, just letting it be accepted. And then eventually the stages of transformation, right? Of just what has this taught me about my worldview or myself?
Right. So
a little bit more gray and fluffy.
Yeah.
But also more realistic.
I love gray and fluffy.
There's this feeling of dissociation that happens too with trauma and with grief. This feeling of like numbness, like I don't think I feel anything. Mm-hmm. I'm just kind of like numb, and we call that dissociation. And I'll have people all the time that come in and they're like, I don't feel anything. I just feel numb. And we know that it's not a lack of feeling that's creating that. It's in fact that the feelings are so big that your brain says, we can't do that. I can't.
Interesting.
Right now. So we have to do, in those situations, we do a lot of like grounding exercises and getting people back in their body and kind of normalizing what's happening. And especially someone with a lot of childhood trauma, right? Like they might exist in a space of dissociation, of feeling numb through life and not really knowing what they're feeling, how to identify it. And that's a scary place to be, especially in terms of like safety. And if you have someone with childhood trauma that's been holding all this in for so long, you can't expect them to sit down and be like, here's what I'm thinking and feeling. Here's what happened to me.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's dangerous. It's reckless.
Yeah.
So, and they can't even identify it. So using something like art or movement or music can start to kind of build that rapport and tap into different parts of the brain to process information that might be kind of hiding underneath there.
It must be very satisfying when you have those aha moments, when you see those things coming up and you're like, oh, we are cooking now. We're cooking now. Right? Are you like, I am good at what I do, right?
Screw it, you're high-fiving yourself.
That must be the best. Yeah.
Absolutely. It is the absolute best. Or when change is so slow and so scary and somehow we tend to convince ourselves that we're stuck in situations that we're never really stuck in. Mm-hmm. But change can just, and that's a whole nother podcast, right? The stages of change, but like change can just be slow. And when a client gets to a point where they come into session or they send a text or an email that's like, I did the thing. And you're just like,
yeah,
you did, like you took the step and so rewarding. Or when something clicks, that's just like, that's why I do that. That's why I behave that way.
Yeah.
Just like, there's a freedom in it.
Yeah.
Or you just like, yeah, I should do this for a living, huh? Right? I should.
Please leave a Yelp review. And
that's taking me into my next question. When I mentioned earlier, I talked about my dad who was diagnosed with cancer and he passed away relatively quickly. And so he passed away in October. And every October since, every single October since he passed away, I'm overwhelmed, right? Like work, parenting, home stuff, everything feels, I have trouble managing it all. And I joke with my family, my husband, with everybody, like, I think I have PTSD because dad died in October and I just don't know what to do when this rolls around every year. So how can people who have experienced similar Octobers in their lives try to kind of mitigate this annual response?
Yeah. And what you're talking about is that idea of, you know, it's kind of become a buzzword now, but triggers, right? Like you're triggered. So when we experience a trauma or a major loss, it really does rewire our neural pathway. So you will now associate something with that loss, but it might not even be conscious. right? Mm-hmm. Like it might just be something that is being triggered in your brain that now all of a sudden you're just, I am irritable. I am snappy. I don't know what's going on with me. I'm in a mood. Mm-hmm. But it really is those neural pathways that are being triggered around whatever stimulus might have been happening at the time of the loss or something that wasn't fully experienced at the time of the loss. Mm-hmm. So having those triggers, it's important to kind of identify where they're coming from so that you are in control, right? So that idea of emotion regulation so that you can understand, I need to be a little bit more gentle with myself today. Or today might be a day that I don't say yes to the extra thing and I actually go for a walk instead.
Yeah. But
you can do that when you're aware of what's happening. So I think for you to recognize that, you're kind of putting that into practice a little bit. Yeah. It's just now putting the step in front of it to say, how can I keep myself safe?
Yeah.
You know, for this period of time. But I think there's also this expectation then of like managing the holidays is something a lot about with
sure.
So, there's also these expectations that we put on ourselves to maintain the tradition, to remember the person, to do the thing that they would always do. Mm-hmm. And there can be a lot of freedom in taking that expectation off of yourself, right? Just because your dad always carved the turkey at Thanksgiving doesn't mean that someone else is now taking his place to carve the turkey. Maybe the year after the loss, you get turkey breasts instead, or maybe you eat ham, or maybe you sit and honor, this is going to be different this year. But a lot of times we try to keep things the same as a way of honoring the loss. And it's okay if it's different. Like the world is different now. Your dad might be gone and that is different.
Right.
So it's okay to give yourself permission to not follow through with things just because that's the way they always were if it doesn't feel right. So if you create a new ritual or a new tradition around hanging a certain ornament together with your family or making a joke about the turkey, whatever it might be, you can honor them in different ways, but you don't need to hold on to what you know to be true from the past.
In our business, a lot of times, right, we were dealing with husband and wife. And if one of them passes, sometimes the other now has to take on financial responsibilities, make decisions that maybe they haven't been a part of. Then you have children, perhaps, that are inheriting assets. And there's some emotions that come with all that stuff. So if you could maybe give us some ideas on, A, how maybe people that can go through and inherit money, how they can deal with it. And also, how can we approach that and you want to be respectful, you want to be understanding, but at the same time, as Jeff pointed out, life is going on. So we have to kind of move forward with the plan.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's when the two worlds butt up against each other, right? Because my therapist brain wants to be like, you got to feel your feeling. Feel the feeling.
And I'm a capitalist.
And then there's this part of like, well, right, but who's going to manage the house? Like, who's going to take over the business? So whatever is happening, there is a level of reality that is there as well. And I think that one of the best things that I've kind of encouraged clients to do that are in active grief is identify a grief advocate. And that sounds so clinical. So I'll break it down a little bit. It is not a clinical role, but this idea of a grief advocate, that's like, I can't email the school and tell them about this loss. I can't email my financial planner and say, this is what we're looking at. I can't cancel my partner's doctor's appointments that they had, or even I can't answer all of the texts that are coming in. Please hold my phone for 3 days. So there's this idea of like a grief advocate who could be your best friend, your sibling, depending on the loss, your child, depending, whoever it might be, but putting someone kind of in the front to collect the information and then be able to present it to you. So being able to say like, okay, these are the decisions in front of you right now. What do you want to do? How do you want me to communicate it? So it's not flying in overwhelming to the person. It's kind of being collected and then being brought to them in a way that's gentle by someone they feel safe with.
Yeah.
Kind of a one point person.
That's a great idea. Yeah. It's like we ask clients, who's your trusted person? Who's your power of attorney? We could do that. Ask, do you have a grief?
Do you have a grief advocate? Yeah.
So I think that grief advocate can kind of allow the processing to be out of the person's space. And then, like I said, given gently kind of in smaller doses so that safe and not impulsive decisions are made.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a level of like empathy and compassion that's going into it.
So I want to talk about kids, right? And being vulnerable around our kids. Like when I grew up, I distinctly remember when my grandmother passed away and my mom got emotional in front of me talking about her or something. And it was the first time in all of my years up to that point, I think I was 15, that I had ever seen her cry. And I feel like I cry every other day here. So like.
Not at work. Outside of work.
Especially
right?
In October.
In the stairway.
Like every day. Like my kids. So like, what advice do you have for people who want to be strong for their kids? The kids are grieving too, but they don't want to be vulnerable around their kids. Or should they? Maybe you can tap on that a little.
Oh my gosh. Yes. So this idea that we shouldn't cry in front of our kids is complete BS. Mm-hmm. I mean. We are teaching our kids how they should process emotions, how they should emotionally regulate, that feelings are normal.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're sitting there trying to be stoic and strong, whatever that means, we aren't modeling to them what to do when they do feel an emotion.
Yeah.
So what we're really passing on is anger, right? Because anger covers up fear and sadness in a way that's socially acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And repression. So you're kind of like covering up these things that are totally normal with maladaptive coping mechanisms.
Yeah.
So again, everything needs to be age appropriate, and you're not going to give information to children that they would not be able to understand. But your child seeing you cry when something sad happened is completely acceptable.
Okay.
It is showing them I can have feelings. And I can still be okay.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to have the smile on your face and be strong to be okay. Feelings are feelings.
Yeah.
Things happen. And showing that vulnerability to our kids, I think, is a very important life skill in letting them be comfortable with their own feelings moving forward. One of the biggest things that I tell parents with kids is you can be vulnerable and you can apologize. I don't know why. This idea that like we can't apologize to our kids.
Infallible adult.
I agree completely. Yes.
Like I snapped on my daughter one day. She was borrowing my clothes and I'm a neat freak and something was out of place. And I was like, if you're going to borrow my clothes, then blah, blah, blah. She didn't deserve it. She was running late and grabbed a sweatshirt.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, I said to her, you know what? I'm really sorry that I snapped at you like that. You didn't deserve it. And that was totally on me. And I apologize. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah,
that's a human experience. That's an emotional reaction. You're apologizing for the way you handled it because it wasn't appropriate in this case.
Yeah.
And kids are very forgiving. So not only have you modeled vulnerability and accountability, but you've made repair. Right.
Yeah.
So it's kind of just understanding that those vulnerabilities are actually what make us humans and allow them the space to be their own individual person.
I can't let you leave without asking you our signature question, which we ask all of our guests, Steph, and that is, well, two questions. First, what is your first memory surrounding money? And also, what does money mean to you?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think I have a joke with my friend that like, if I could put all my money in my mattress, like I'm fine with that. It feels comfortable.
Ah.
You know where it is.
Okay.
But I also know that that's not healthy. That's not financial health.
So, we were going to have to add another hour.
So I think for me, I'm not a super risk taker, right? So like moderate risk, making sure I always feel in control, kind of my own anxieties. That's important to me with money. My dad did a great job of teaching me financial safety and financial success, but he also scared the crap out of me. And I remember feeling like if you're ever late to pay a phone bill, like you'll never be able to get a house. You'll never be able to get any kind. So this like fear of almost fear-based education around money obviously has translated into my love for money and my mattress.
Well, I'll tell you what, you have made the topic of grief. You've made it an enjoyable hour.
A lot of good nuggets. We got some great nuggets today. Yeah. Thank you.
I feel lighter too. Is that normal? Is everybody?
I do too. So Steph, tell our listeners about your practice and where they can find you if they need to find you? Tell us.
Yeah, so I'm in Morristown. I'm at the Chrysalis Counseling Center. I do clients in person. I know we have a few therapists on staff that also offer telehealth services. And we have art therapists, child therapists. I work with adults specifically, but we do have child and adolescent therapists on staff as well, and are happy to provide support or even referrals if anybody needs help. And that is the hardest part of therapy, is seeking out the therapy. That once that's done, that is the hardest part.
We could get some cards and hand them to people. Trust me, we can give you a recipe.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Stephanie, thank you so much for your time. And thanks for stopping by.
Thank you for stopping by.
And Doug, I'll see you in bar on Friday.
That's a cool one.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.